You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.
How do we become a sustainable world? As the stakes for our survival continues to rise, so does our global consciousness. We are in the midst of a great spiritual awakening and are laying the foundations for a happy, peaceful, just, and sustainable world. With clear vision, determination, and a positive attitude, we are making sustainability happen. The transformation is already underway. You are listening to Sustainable Futures.
Welcome to Sustainable Futures. On today's episode, we're going to have an interview with Nancy Ulweiler, who is an environmental economist and director of SFU's public policy program.
We use our natural environment to produce those goods that we like to have and keep us alive, like food, our furniture, etc. So to think that the economy and the environment are divorced or somehow separate is really a pretty faulty way of looking at the world.
And Ryan has two short interviews. The first is with the mayor of Oak Bay, Christopher Costin, and they're talking about the town's decision to allow electric cars on main roads.
Just thought, you know what? Not going to cause an inconvenience to our community. Mm-hmm. It'll send a very strong message that this needs to be encouraged. So we just turned around and did it.
Ryan also speaks with Ben Stewart from Greenpeace UK about the verdict of the high-profile King's North case.
We were charged with about $60,000 of criminal damage. And a year later, we went to court and we had a jury trial. Our defense was that we were justified in causing that $60,000 worth of damage because the damage that the power station does to the environment is that much more. And there is a defense in law called lawful excuse that allows you to argue this.
I'm Ryan Fletcher.
And I'm Kim Tay.
And you are listening to Sustainable Futures.
All right, so how are you doing today, Ryan?
I'm well today, yes. It's a very nice autumn day. I had a really great hike up the mountain today with all the leaves on the ground.
Very good. Well, on today's episode, I'm actually really looking forward to this because I've been wanting to interview Nancy Ulweiler for quite a while, since the summertime, actually, because she is one of, I would say, Canada's foremost environmental economists. She's quite well known for her work in that area, and she's also the director of SFU's public policy program, and that's a master's program. And I wanted to talk to her about environmental economics. And I know I've been doing a few interviews on environmental economics recently, but specifically I wanted to speak to her about carbon taxes and cap and trade systems. I wanted somebody whose specialty is environmental economics to explain exactly what a carbon tax is and what a cap and trade system is, because I think that there are a lot of misconceptions about what those things are. And I wanted somebody to explain that and put it in plain words to say, this is what it is. At its very heart, this is what it means and this is what it can do for us and this is why it's important. So it was a really great interview. This is actually one of my most favorite interviews that I've done and I'm really looking forward to it.
And so am I. It's great to be talking about the economy, especially after the Canadian election and with the American election just having past to highlight sort of something that's always central to the discussions around elections is always the economy. So,
yeah,
it's well, definitely, and I think, good to marry the two big issues.
Yes, I think so. And I think especially in our current economic climate, I think that there is a lot of misconception about how the economy and the environment are related to each other. You know, environmental economists will say the economy is the environment. It's mm-hmm. not divorced of one another. They are one and the same thing. Other people will say you can't have a strong economy and give all of this to the environment. It's kind of jobs or the environment. And it doesn't have to be. It totally is one and the same thing. And I think, you know, in our current economic climate, it really is important to take a look at that relationship.
I think the biggest obstacle will be those people that are afraid to change. I think that's basically what it comes down to for those naysayers about the environment and the economy, is that I think basically they're just afraid to change the way things are.
Well, sure. And I think that there's also the current opinion that to do something that is more environmentally preferable costs more money.
Mm-hmm.
But when I look at it, I think, sure, it may cost more money right now. However, what is it going to cost us in the future?
Mm-hmm. And you just have to look at countries in Europe that are already doing this and see that how their economies are doing, because they are doing very well.
They are. Yeah, definitely. I think that, well, I think in general, Europe is leaps and bounds ahead of North America, but that's a whole other story. So yeah, a really great interview. I hope that the listeners enjoy it and walk away with some information about carbon taxes and kind of the basics of it. But then also I'm really looking forward to the two other interviews that you did, Ryan. Mm-hmm. And those are really current topics as well.
Yeah, the second interview is actually about a big change that will have economic implications. And that is the District of Oak Bay, which is a suburb of Victoria, BC, has decided to legalize the use of electric cars in their streets. And we had a discussion about what the implications of that are. And since then, Vancouver has then gone and done the same thing for Vancouver, which of course is affecting far more people than just a district of Victoria. Now we have the Metropolitan of Vancouver saying it's okay to go and get your electric cars and drive in the streets.
Yeah, and I haven't actually heard anything about Vancouver's policy on electric cars since it was originally established. I haven't heard anything about it since, so I'd be really interested in finding out more about what stage it's at now, and then even further down the road. Even further down the road.
You crack me up.
Oh, even further down the road to see how many more electric cars there are actually on the road. Mm-hmm. If I could afford it, I would totally do that. I would have an electric car, or even buy a current gas-powered car and transform it into an electric car.
Yeah, I hope to see that in the future.
Yeah.
And the other interview was with Ben Stewart from the Greenpeace in the UK, and they had a really inspiring decision to a court case. Basically, Greenpeace UK was protesting the oncoming of a new coal plant in the UK, and they were lawfully excused for their activist activities. So you'll hear all about their story and what exactly they did and how the court case went.
So first up here is Nancy Olawiler talking about the environment, economics, carbon taxes, and cap and trade systems, and our current economic climate. This is Kim Tay reporting for Sustainable Futures. I'm joined today by Nancy Olawiler, who is an environmental economist and the director of SFU's Master of Public Policy program. Thanks so much for speaking with me today, Nancy.
My pleasure.
All right, so to get started, maybe because I think a lot of people have a misconception about the economy and what economics actually is, can you maybe give a brief description about how the economy and the environment are related?
Well, gosh, I mean, without the environment, there would be no economy. That's the simple story, is that we, you know, our natural environment provides the life support systems for the whole planet, including people. So in sort of more economic terms, we like to say that the natural environment provides what we call natural capital, which is our ecosystems, our atmosphere, our water, our natural resources. And we use our natural environment to produce those goods that we like to have and keep us alive, like food, our furniture, etc. So to think that the economy and the environment are divorced or somehow separate is really a pretty faulty way of looking at the world.
How did we come to a point then of separating them? Because a lot of people will argue that if we create policies to protect the environment, we will lose jobs and our economy will collapse and all of these things. How did we get to the point of separating them and think that it's one or the other?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't have all the answers, but maybe the short answer is that it's focusing on the costs of improving environmental quality rather than focusing on the benefits of improving environmental quality is where we got down that track. So people that oppose doing the kinds of things that sustain our environment and hence sustain us like to just talk about costs. If we have a policy, this is what it's going to cost us. And of course, if we put more effort into one type of activity, there are going to be trade-offs. If we put more money into restoring our natural environment out of a fixed government budget, that may mean less money for healthcare or something else. So it's in that sense I think people view the trade-offs. But I view it as a false dichotomy for the reasons that I mentioned earlier, is that we can't function without a high-quality environment. And secondly, by investing in the environment, it doesn't mean we're going to reduce jobs. It means that we'll reallocate those jobs. So for every sector that gets fewer jobs, there may be sectors that grow in jobs. So let me give you a concrete example. If we switch to renewable electricity, renewable energy for electricity, we will create jobs in the renewable electricity sectors. We may lose jobs in the traditional fossil fuel sectors. What's going to be the net gain or loss? Well, that's something that we can check, but it's not just loss, loss, loss.
When we talk about something like climate change, how can you explain that in an economic perspective?
Well, climate change, it's a big topic.
Yes.
let me talk about, you know, sort of the general problem that we see in any kind of environmental contaminant or environmental issue. And that is that for forever, humans have been looking at the environment as a waste depository in addition to all the goods and services it provides. And it's been something that's around us, it absorbs us, and we can discharge our wastes freely. So if you get to use something for free, you get kind of crabby when you have to start paying for it. And climate change is a classic example where if I cut my consumption of a greenhouse gas generating activity, so let's say I drive my car a little less, I will reduce my emissions by a significant but small amount relative to the world. And I may be thinking, well, why should I do that? Because, you know, taking public transit may make me, you know, take a little bit longer to get to work as opposed to driving my car. So I'm not forced to pay for that. I'm just one of millions, billions of people contributing to this decline in our natural environment. So we call it a free rider problem. Why should I pay when I really would rather somebody else do it? Or why should I be concerned about my waste products when I'm just a teeny little part of the whole problem? But you see, when we all start thinking that way, we don't have a teeny problem anymore. We have a big problem. So climate change, as a result of emissions of GHGs, are simply the decisions of all of us individuals saying, you know, I'm not that big a share of the problem. I'll just keep doing what I'm doing.
We're looking at everybody else and saying, well, everybody's doing it, therefore I can do it too.
Yeah, and I don't want to pay. Why should I pay if you're not? So suppose I switch my habits, but you don't. You know, why should I be the good guy and you're the person that's going, well, you know, why should I worry about this? It may happen 50 years from now, 100 years from now. Why should I be the one that sacrifices what I'm doing right now? And it's not to say that people are totally selfish or self-centered. It's just that it's a big problem because we all contribute to the emission of all these environmental contaminants, of which GHGs are simply one.
I've read that climate change is an example of market failure.
Yep, that's what I'm talking about.
That's exactly what it is. So
yeah. In
a sense, like the market or maybe you can explain this, should the market be able to take care of these problems on its own? You know, I've heard of like the invisible hand of the economy. Is that what this is?
Well, the invisible hand works well when we can identify a product and we can restrict people who don't pay from using it. And that's the problem with environmental issues, is that we can't stop you from doing what you're doing. There's no way we can force you to pay. So let me give you an example of an environmental good. I go across the street to get a cup of tea. If I don't pay for it, they don't serve me the tea. But if I decide to go out and burn a fossil fuel in my fireplace or drive more, there's nobody saying, Nancy, you've got to pay more because you're putting more stress on the environment. So it's when we're in it together. So that's this idea that each one of us are contributing to it, and I can't restrict your use of the environment, unlike if you don't pay for my cup of tea, you don't get it. That's the market failure.
Has the market ever worked? Has it always been a market failure?
Pretty much. In small, in a community where people are directly involved and all of the actions of the community contribute to the problem, there may be some collective action where people say, you know, we are the ones, let's take polluting a lake that we like to swim in. So we're a little community around the lake, and we all say, you know, it's us dumping our raw sewage into the lake, which is affecting the fish and our ability to enjoy the lake. We might, as a community, decide any one of us doing it on our own won't be enough. We have to, as a community, decide to do that. So, yes, there are examples of that sort of thing happening. But when we get to climate change, and we're talking about the whole world needing to act, it's very difficult to proceed on a voluntary basis. That's why there's a role for government policy.
So how do we move beyond this point of market failure and actually correct what is going wrong right now? How can we do that economically? What's the best way to do that?
Well, there are many ways to do it, and I don't like to use the word best because every policy has a trade-off. But number one, as I just suggested, we do need the involvement of our government sector, and here our government has to take a leadership role in adopting policies that move us closer to treating the environment as an essential good, essential to life. So we have at our disposal sort of two types of policies, one that use the market system more. Those would be taxes and market systems, such as you've heard about cap-and-trade systems. The other is a regulatory approach. And depending on the problem and the severity, there's not one size fits all. Some policies are better in some instances than others. So if we have a really toxic compound, for example, we don't want to mess around with saying, well, let's try to have a market and see how much we can get it reduced. We want to restrict its use. But if we're talking about things that require, you know, pretty systemic changes in society, where we're trying to get the price system right, we're trying to say to people, you know, you should pay more every time you put your foot on the accelerator because you are contributing to this problem, then I believe that a pricing-like mechanism is going to be the one that's better because it affects you every time you put your foot on the accelerator. And then which one within the pricing systems, cap and trade versus taxes, again, we get into some of the finer details. Both can be useful, but it depends on what level we're going to apply them to all consumers, just to people who are producing the materials upstream. We get into all kinds of interesting design issues then.
And in terms of limiting carbon emissions, is a carbon tax better than the cap and trade system, or can you use both?
You can use both, and this is where you have to get into the very nitty-gritty of how you're going to use the taxes or the cap-and-trade system. So what kind of cap-and-trade system are we going to adopt? Who is it going to cover? Are we going to give people the allowances, or are we going to auction them? Those sort of very specific design questions that make it difficult for me to say, well, yeah, we should use one versus the other. Both can be used effectively, but you have to get into the details of how you're going to apply them, who's going to be facing these policies.
For those people who aren't familiar with a carbon tax and a cap and trade system, can you provide, I know that they're complicated mechanisms, but can you give an easy to understand explanation of what the two are and how they differ from each other?
Sure. At a fundamental level, they are very comparable to each other in that the attempt of both is to put a price per ton on carbon. So a tax does it directly by saying, as in the BC carbon tax, for every ton of carbon you emit, you will pay $10 at the current prices. And that because carbon is an easy thing to design a policy for in one respect, and that is we know the carbon content of all of the fuels. So in the BC carbon tax, we know that a $10 per ton CO2 translates into 2.47 or 46 cents per liter. And we'll have a different price for diesel and a different price for natural gas and coal. A cap and trade system puts a price per ton of carbon, but instead of deciding that by the government setting the price, the market will set the price. So what a cap and trade system does is it either sells or gives to people who are responsible for using the carbon, And here's we get into whether it's the people, primary producers, or a little bit more down the supply chain. It says to them, you're allowed to emit, let's say, 1 ton. They have the same decision they have with a tax. They can emit that 1 ton, use their permit, and live happily ever after. Or they can say, you know, it's cheaper for me to reduce my emissions and sell my permit. And so that's how the price gets established, by people making decisions on what's best for them to do. A tax is exactly identical. You can emit the ton and pay the tax, or you can not emit the ton and hence save the tax. So in principle, they're both the same. And some of the political rhetoric that was emerging in the election we just had confuses those issues, and I think have greatly confused voters unnecessarily. So in principle, the two policies are very similar in that they both price carbon. The difference is, under a tax, the government sets the price, and under a cap-and-trade system, the market determines the price. So in one system, we know the price. In the other, we don't know, because it depends on how many permits there are for sale on the market at any point in time and how many buyers there are. I hope that helps.
I think so, because there are so many misconceptions. And I think that in the media and through the elections and politics, that the message is getting misconstrued and it's getting a little bit mixed up. And people are going, well, I don't want to be taxed more. Could you explain what you think some of the biggest misconceptions are about either the carbon tax or a cap and trade system?
Sure. First of all, on the carbon tax, and let's just look at BC's because that's where we are, one of the misconceptions is that, well, I'm the consumer is the only person that pays. That's wrong. Everybody who burns a fuel that emits carbon pays the carbon tax. So it's not the case, as has been alleged by some, that the carbon tax is just a tax on the ordinary person and the big bad polluters are not covered by the tax. If you emit a ton of carbon, you will pay the carbon tax. And every business that is in the process of burning a fuel will pay the tax. So that's one of the misconceptions. A second one on the cap and trade is that the prices that get established in the market don't flow through to the consumers, because we're only going to include in a cap and trade system, say, that what we call the upstream producers, the people that extract the fossil fuels or initially burn it. Well, that's wrong too, because the point of either a carbon tax or cap and trade is to affect prices so that people, A, reduce their consumption, and B, switch to cleaner fuels. So the notion that a cap and trade will not affect the consumer is simply wrong. It will depend on how much responsiveness we get in both sectors to either the tax, in both conditions to either the tax or cap and trade. So to me, those are big ones. It's not the case that cap and trade is benign from the viewpoint of consumers. If it was, it wouldn't have any effect.
In all cases, if you implement a carbon tax, are taxes reduced in other areas?
That's a policy decision. Mm. And this is where the BC proposal, for example, differs from the federal Liberal proposal, the Green Shift. And in the BC proposal, it is a law that every dollar of revenue that the government collects in the carbon tax will get returned to the citizens of British Columbia. And the way the government has done it is, of course, they're forecasting revenues, and they have already implemented tax cuts at both the personal and the corporate level. So in BC, every dollar by law must be returned to the people in the province. In the federal system, it's a little different. They do have a tax cut, or did in their proposal have a tax cut as part of the return of the carbon tax revenues, but they were also going to earmark some of them for assistance to sectors in meeting their carbon targets. So assistance to the high energy using sectors to adopt new technology to reduce their emissions, that sort of thing. So that's a policy decision.
One of the main fears I hear from people is that the carbon tax will make things more expensive and they're just going to end up paying more for things. But if it's a law that in BC, at least, that we get all that money back, how do you address that misconception? Like, how do you get people to understand that this is just, you know, directed towards certain things, but you will get that money back?
Yeah, well, you know, we should have more concrete examples, I think, to tell people. So, yeah. The point of the tax is to raise the price of carbon-intensive activities. So you have a choice. If nothing else happened in the world oil markets, the price of gasoline would go up the 2.4 cents a liter. You then have a choice. Do I drive a little less? Do I do exactly the same thing I've done before and pay the tax? Let's say you do nothing and you drive more. So 2.4 cents a liter, and let's say you drive 20,000 kilometers a year, you can work out how much more you're going to pay in taxes. So, you know, the average person drives, and you can figure this out for yourself. So 0.024 times 20,000 kilometers is $480 a year. So that's what it'll cost you just on gasoline alone. And then you look at, well, what's going to happen with my income tax cuts? And for a, you know, a family of moderate income, the income tax cuts may be something on the order of $600, $800 a year. So you're paying more for one thing, which is your driving of your car, because it's a carbon-intensive activity. On the other hand, you have more money in your wallet, so it's your choice. But we need more concrete examples like that. Now, not everybody will be like I explained. I mean, the kind of household I explained will be better off in the monetary sense, in that the tax cut will more than offset their incremental energy costs. But if you're a very heavy user of fossil fuels, you will pay more under the system. But that is kind of the point. We're trying to induce people to shift their patterns of buying and consumption to less damaging fuels. And we do have substitutes. You can swap out your light bulbs and have, you know, more compact fluorescent lights. You can switch to public transit. You can not drive your kids to school, but actually let the little darlings walk. I mean, it's not that people have no choice.
Mm-hmm. But it's almost like we want everything and more.
We want somebody else to pay. It would be much nicer if you would pay instead of me. And that's, we come back to your market failure. If we all think that way, then no one will pay. We'll vote out any government that wants to try to get us on a path to controlling our emissions. And, you know, we'll suffer the consequences downstream. And at least in British Columbia, we already see the consequences of climate change. So, you know, it's kind of a societal choice. What do you want? Do you want to leave your children and their children a world where they threaten our very existence because you won't change your behaviors? You won't switch to something that's a little bit less fuel intensive and over time less and less fuel intensive? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a big social question.
A big moral question.
A big moral question.
Yeah. Do you think that the carbon tax in British Columbia has been successful so far?
It's too successful is, well, we'd have to define what success is.
Okay.
Success would mean we stop increasing our use of carbon-based fuels, or we reduce our incremental use of carbon-based fuels. We have, as the population grows, of course, the pressure is to use more and more of these fuels. So success would mean we start lowering that curve of increasing fuel use. So we are going to use more fuels. The question is, can we kind of flatten that increase out? And the second thing is, can we start adopting cleaner fuels? So success would mean we are moving to a path that reduces our carbon emissions, both by reducing our consumption of carbon-intensive activities and by switching to cleaner fuels and get the same quality of life. That would be success. So it's too early to tell. The tax has been implemented at a low level that, if you ask the experts, is this enough to get people to change their behavior, the answer is no. 2.4 cents a liter, no matter how much anybody gripes, is less than a fraction of what the price of gasoline has been on the market. We know the price of carbon is going to have to go up, and what British Columbia has done is to signal, we're going to price carbon, and we're going to tell you the price is going up. So we want you to have time to adjust and get used to it and make those kinds of choices and changes that will reduce our path from one of carbon intensity to less damaging fuel use.
What is your perception of people's reaction to the tax? Do you think that people are very, very angry about it, or do you feel that people have been somewhat more, you know, maybe not so happy about it, but accepting of it?
I think there's a wide spectrum of responses from everything you said, from people who phone in and say the carbon tax is ruining my life, to people that say it's about time we did something concrete about it. And I think we all have to have a reality check here in terms of, you know, the carbon ruining my life end of the spectrum. You know, there are lots of things to ruin your life. Carbon taxes, probably well down the list. But it's, you know, because of the things we've talked about earlier, because of the confusion about policies aided and abetted by some of our political leaders, because of the media's need to create controversy and dissent and get people fired up, we haven't had what I believe is an honest and true discussion of what we're going to do as a society. It comes back to what you said earlier. You know, what are we going to do? Are we going to do nothing because we are so selfish, is the word I have to use, that we won't change our behavior? Or do we want to do something that will move us on a path to getting a cleaner, a healthier environment that might sustain life? Well, talk to the people in the interior British Columbia who've already seen the impact of climate change on their livelihoods. Mm-hmm. The pine beetle. I mean, we have destroyed massive amounts of forested land. So climate change has already impacted the economy of many parts of British Columbia. And if you look at what the potential impacts will be down the road, I think people have to start shaking their heads and say, you know, the quality of life I think I have now, I'm not sure we can sustain this if I don't become part of the solution instead of part of the problem.
Right. And that ties back to the relationship between the economy and the environment. Like, that's part, a huge part of BC's economy that is being ruined.
Yep.
So
it's more to come. The salmon fisheries, both the sport and the commercial fisheries, are threatened by ocean water. Temperature rises. We know already that the salmon stocks have, you know, there are lots of stressors on salmon stock, but warmer water temperatures is certainly one of them. When the salmon go, the orca go. When the orca go, we lose another icon of British Columbia. Mm-hmm. I mean, how, you know, maybe you say, well, it was nice. We had those orca for a while. They're magnificent animals, but I don't care if they're gone. But then we start looking at all the other productive things that our water and our atmosphere do for us. And pretty soon, you know, we're on that slope sliding down.
How does the financial crisis change everything? How does that impact carbon tax policies or carbon policies in general?
Well, in a couple of, I mean, in many ways. The first, of course, is what we already discussed, and that is the attention of people worldwide is on this quite extraordinary and very devastating effect that's going on in our financial world and indeed will spill over into the economy as a whole. So it's tough to talk about effects that may occur in 10, 20 years when you've got something that's happening right now and is hitting worldwide. So attention will be diverted. The second thing is we are, you know, it's likely unless this thing stabilizes quickly, we will probably find it very challenging to continue to have economic growth in this country. So that means people will start worrying about their jobs, their incomes. And, you know, you can imagine going out and saying, well, now we're going to change relative prices. You may still be better off, which our example from before, I'm paying, let's say, $500 more in energy costs, but I'm getting $800 back in taxes. I'm still better off. But it's harder, you know, we need even more effort to make those kind of links to people than we did before. So getting people's attention and getting clarity about our carbon policies is even more imperative now. It doesn't mean we should just say, okay, there's nothing we can do. Because a carbon policy with recycling of the revenues back to people may actually be good for the economy right now. Mm-hmm. You know, in opposition to what our federal leader said, that carbon taxes will cause a recession, it could be something that would help offset the recession by allowing people to have more money overall in their pockets and just changing the price of fuels. So it's going to be tougher. I completely agree with that, but it's certainly not a reason to say we can't talk about the environment now because the financial world is such a mess. It's even more imperative to talk about it because it may be part of the solution.
That's one thing that hasn't actually been talked about a lot. I've seen sporadic reports here and there about people who have said, if we invest in something like clean energy, that could be the innovation that we need to spur on the economy and help get us out of the financial crisis. Is that something that you look at positively?
Sure. I mean, if we're, again, the fundamental thing about effective economic policies for carbon is that it changes the mix in the economy. So, I mean, let's go back to think about before we had automobiles and we were driving around in wagons. The key good here is transportation. It's not the mechanism of transportation. It's not whether, you know, I really would rather have a horse because that's more environmentally, well, it wasn't really, but it was a different kind of environmental impact than a car. So we're still talking about moving people from A to B, but just doing it in a cleaner way. How can that be bad for the economy? We're still going to have the goods and services that we want. We just want to do it in a more effective way, effective meaning it has less damage to our natural environment. So we're going to have to invest in our infrastructure no matter what. How about building a more energy-efficient building now instead of a cheap one that's going to leak and rot faster? I mean, it's got to be positive for the economy.
And so, therefore, could be part of the solution to
Absolutely.
The financial crisis.
Well, it'll be a, you know...
part of.
Let's be serious here.
Right.
It's much more important to keep our financial institutions from going down the drain because that will affect all of us immediately.
Yeah.
But, again, I come back to... It is certainly not the time to say we cannot address environmental policy because what we do can be helpful. Will it solve the problems? Heavens no. But will it be a factor that helps our economies survive this onslaught from the financial world, something that we did not create at all? This is not like, you know, this is not us doing it. It's other countries. But we live in a global environment, so just as we suffer from global pollutants, we suffer from global financial crises. But can taking action on the environment help? Yes, I believe so.
Well, thank you so much, Nancy. I really do appreciate you explaining these complex policies.
You know, I'm just delighted to do my little part to get people to discuss them at a level that, as I said, that we're discussing the right questions and the right issues.
Mm-hmm.
And right from the viewpoint that we're not talking about false or, you know, misconceptions.
Mm-hmm.
These are tough questions. It means a fundamental change
yeah.
in the way we do things in terms of pricing the goods and the things we use that will make our environment better off or worse off. So it's a fundamental change.
Well, thank you so much, Nancy. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Now for my interview with Mayor Costin of Oak Bay, BC.
This is Ryan Fletcher of Sustainable Futures, and I have Mayor Costin of Oak Bay, British Columbia on the line. And Oak Bay has recently legalized electric cars on the streets. What is the significance of that?
The province changed the rules back in June of this year and permitted electric vehicles on streets where the default speed limit was 50K, and that made it very simple for us in Oak Bay, where we don't have any highways,
mm-hmm.
to allow them to be used on our roads.
So because there's no big speedy highways, that's what makes it okay?
Well, most people drive fairly slowly here anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Although the maximum is 50, the majority of people drive at 40, 42K. That's the top speed of an electric car. It didn't seem to us that that was a major barrier. And quite frankly, looking at new technologies, council didn't want to put any barriers in the way of people being able to develop alternative fuel cars. So electric was a natural for us to support. It had also been brought to our attention in the past year various makes of electric cars. We'd been offered a electric truck in 2007 to test in our parks department, and I was offered another electric car to drive in the Oak Bay Tea Party. So I was very aware,
mm-hmm.
as was council, of the technology. We were also aware that various very large manufacturers such as GM were increasingly trying to get a model on the road, the GM
yeah.
Volt, in 2010. So we just thought, you know what, it's not going to cause an inconvenience to our community.
Mm-hmm.
It'll send a very strong message that this needs to be encouraged. So we just turned around and did it.
And has that encouraged more drivers in Oak Bay? Have you
well,
found that?
What we're trying to do, Ryan, is trying to encourage the technology.
Yes.
The drivers will come. I mean, I think in London, you're seeing all kinds of electric cars now. I think there's all kinds of electric cars being seen around the streets of London. They're exempt from the London congestion charge. You can park for free, and the road tax is zero. So London, the city of London, is doing exactly the right thing to encourage the technology. As a result, they're seeing people driving them, and they're seeing people go into dealerships and ask for them. In our little small way, that's what we were trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to have exemption from parking or congestion charges because there's no cost to parking in Oak Bay anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose we've become leaders in Canada, but quite frankly, other cities in the world are doing it and leading just as, they're showing great examples, and London's just one of them.
Are you talking London, England?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And is the city set up for electric vehicles in other ways?
No, it's not. But having said that, it's a very tight community in a geographic sense. The people here, they try and reduce their carbon footprint as much as possible. You can plug these in at your home or in your garage.
Mm-hmm.
So that's not an issue. We don't have plug-in meters, and, you know, obviously if they catch on, that's something you can do. In fact, I was on Orcas Island in the San Juans, and they've had a meter there for years on the main street that you can plug into, and you can put in a nickel or a dollar and charge your vehicle while you're there. We haven't gone that far because we don't have any parking meters in the first place. I don't want to see anyway. So people can plug them in at home.
Yeah, which is great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Well, Ryan, I hope this helps you. And the success of what we're doing is it will be measured in how many vehicles come to market at an economical price that people then buy.
Yes.
I mean, I think one of the issues is what I hear, the Volt is being touted in the $35,000 to $40,000 range. And quite frankly, that's not the market that I see. I see the people who want, if you like, a little community commuter car, want to pay about $15,000 to $20,000 and able to plug in.
Yeah.
I think if there's a huge capital cost to this, you're going to drive people out of it.
And actually, they're simpler to make than the motorized cars, from what I understand.
What I understand, and I'm hoping that these come out at around about $15,000.
Mm-hmm.
Because then I think you've got a real market.
Yep.
You know, a very inexpensive capital cost and a very inexpensive operating cost, you'd have a real winner.
Thank you for
Good
doing
luck.
Your part.
Pleasure.
That was an interview with Mayor Costin of Oak Bay, BC. And coming up next is an interview with Ben Stewart from Greenpeace UK.
This is Ryan Fletcher of Sustainable Futures, and I'm here with Ben Stewart from England. Thank you for joining us here today on Sustainable Futures.
Hi.
So we're going to be talking about the King's North verdict. It was a big legal case in the UK. And could you just tell us, what was the case? What was the King's North case?
King's North is a coal-fired power station in the south of England, about 40-odd miles from London. And there's a proposal to build a new coal-fired power station next to the current power station, and it would be the first coal plant in the UK for about 30 years. And obviously, it would be absolutely contradictory to any effort to solve climate change. So myself and a few others to raise the issue of this proposed coal plant at King's North last year broke into the site and broke into the smokestack and climbed up the smokestack, a nine-hour climb up a ladder, and got to the top and occupied the power station, shut it down, stopped about 10,000 tons of CO2 going into the atmosphere, and painted down the side of the smokestack. We painted the Prime Minister Gordon Brown's name down the side of it in about 10-foot-high letters. We were charged with about $60,000 of criminal damage, and a year later, we went to court and we had a jury trial. Our defense was that we were justified in causing that $60,000 worth of damage because the damage that the power station does to the environment is that much more. And there is a defense in law called lawful excuse that allows you to argue this. But obviously, it's not designed by Parliament to allow activists like ourselves to somehow escape jail. And we did face a jail sentence if we were found guilty. It was a two-week trial, and it was a very big story over here. And we have witnesses such as Dr. James Hansen, the director of the NASA Goddard Space Center and the advisor to Al Gore on climate change, actually came over from the States to give evidence in our case, as did Akakuk Ling, who is an Inuit leader from Canada. And the result after the two-week trial was that we were found not guilty. We were acquitted. The jury, in a very conservative town, decided that what we did was entirely justified because of the threat of climate change. It's obviously, it was a huge result over here, and has led to, we hope, some thinking within government about the viability of building new coal-fired power stations.
Wow. So there was a proposal for a new plant coming through. Was that the impetus of this?
That's right, yeah. I mean, the proposal's still live, and the government hasn't made the decision yet. But the Kings North case in court made it a huge national story. It led all the national TV news when we were acquitted. And we hope it's helped in the campaign to stop this new coal-fired power station. Of course, you know, the Greenpeace is campaigning on it, but many thousands of people across the country from many different groups, development groups, Oxfam, Christian Aid, and lots of environment groups and civil society are really trying to stop this coal-fired power station, because we can't really ask India and China to stop burning coal if we build new coal-fired power stations that will be operative for 40-odd years. And that's why Dr. Hampson from NASA said that the King's North decision is one of the big climate decisions in the world at the moment. And so it was a fantastic thing to win, not least because I'm not in jail now, which I wasn't particularly looking forward to.
Yes, I guess not.
No.
All right. Thank you very much for spending your time here with us today.
It's a pleasure. Take care, then. Bye-bye.
That was Ben Stewart from Greenpeace UK talking about the King's North verdict. This is something that local environment groups can take great inspiration from and know that the opinion, even as he said it, in a conservative town, could, by this precedent that has been set, be lawful excuse to do activist activities.
So that was an interview with Ben Stewart from Greenpeace UK. He was talking about the King's North case and how he was acquitted from jail time.
Yes.
Good for him. All right.
I love how he put it all into perspective there for his own self.
Yeah.
Talking about the big picture and I don't go to jail.
Yeah, which is good for him.
Yes.
So I hope you enjoyed the show today. I know that we did, but heck, we're biased. So if you have any show ideas or tips or anything like that, you can email us at iamsustainable@gmail.com. That's I-A-M as in mother. And any closing words, Ryan? Closing statements?
On the next episode of Sustainable Futures, there will be a interview with Aaron DeLazer from Ethical Bean, which is a local brewer of fair trade organic coffee. And he's going to touch on all different kinds of aspects of the coffee industry. His official title is Director of Coffee, which is very exciting.
I would like to be the director of coffee. I love it. And we will also have an interview with Rachel Black, who is an anthropologist who specializes in food. And we're going to be talking about the anthropology of food. Food is one of my favorite topics, so I'm going to enjoy next week's show.
So the next episode will be all about food and drink. So get ready to party with us next week.
All right. Well, thanks for tuning in. I'm Kim Tay.
And I'm Ryan Fletcher.
And we are wishing you
a sustainable future.
How do you get around? Like, do you drive by car? Do you ride a bike?
Cycle and walk and bus.
What are some of the reasons why you choose to not drive a car?
Sure, it's healthier. And I live fairly close to work, so it's an easy commute for me. And we've chosen not to own a car, actually.
Great. Have you ever owned a car?
Yeah, I have before, but not since moving to Vancouver.
So what does cycling mean to you then? Like, when you're able to get around by yourself, what does that mean for you?
It's a lot more independence. It's a healthier lifestyle. Sort of gives me a lot more freedom to get places quickly than obviously by walking. So yeah.
Great.
It's exciting.
Did the environmental aspect play a role in your decision to ride a bike more?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think it's healthier for me and it's healthier for the environment as well. So I don't like to contribute to pollution if I can avoid it. So yeah.
When you get around Vancouver, what's your main form of transportation?
I bike everywhere, actually. Yeah. Absolutely.
What's the reason for that?
Because it's a lot cheaper than a vehicle, a car, yeah.
Definitely.
Considerable, yeah.
Is it just primarily the cost that attracted you to riding a bike everywhere, or
well,
any other reasons?
Actually, the exercise level, too. I also like that as well.
Yeah,
for sure. The cost and exercise, and especially on a nice day like this, it's pretty sweet.
So. Yeah. Did the environment play a role at all? Like, you know, make it more a sustainable form of transportation? Did that play a role at all?
It does help. It does help because it cuts back on obviously all the gases and stuff. But
Did you enjoy, or do you enjoy riding your bike?
Yeah, you get quite addicted to it, actually. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, especially when you get a good downhill.
It's the rush.
A nice little rush there. Yeah.
When you think of other people, I mean, we live in such a car-dominated society.
Oh yeah.
What do you see being some of the main barriers that people face in riding a bike to get around?
Well, I would say a lot of people are lazy, to be honest.
Yeah.
It takes a lot more, especially in Vancouver. It takes a lot more effort to bike than it does to hop in a car, because everywhere you go there's a lot of hills, so it can definitely be taxing if you don't work out at all.
You're riding a bike today. Do you normally get around by bike?
Quite a lot, but today's the first day wearing shorts.
It's really nice outside today. Does that make it easier getting around by bike?
Makes the decision to get out on the bike a lot easier, much better than the car on a day like this.
What are some of the reasons that you prefer to get around by bike?
Getting exercise and ease of parking if I'm going downtown, but especially getting exercise. That's why I ride the one speed. It's more exercise than these modern gizmos.
Oh, so you don't even have speeds on it?
There's one, but
just one. Right. Okay. When you see our society and with the amount of cars that are on the road right now, what do you think are some of the barriers that prevent people from getting out and riding a bike to commute?
Let's see, Vancouver still doesn't have enough in the way of cycle routes. For instance, to get downtown, you end up getting pretty wet and dodging traffic getting onto the bridge. And if a slightly higher percentage of road building costs went into improving cycle routes, that would be good. The network's pretty good, but getting across the bridges could be nicer. And there's lots of places where it's hard to lock up a bicycle. I was down at the Bayshore Hotel a couple of weeks ago, and nobody wanted a bicycle out front of their hotel. I have to put it in the garage. So a lot of businesses could improve having showers for being able to change after cycling into work. Gas prices going up is always a good thing.
I think that will encourage people to look for other modes of transportation.
You bet. And I figure the higher the better for gas taxes. Get people to change their ways a bit.
What else do you think that we need to encourage people to choose other modes of transportation other than a car?
It's not so bad in Vancouver, but in outlying areas, the cities have been expanding in a way that is geared up only for having a car. So, for instance, if you lived in any dwelling in Richmond that had been built in the last 40 years, you really have to own a car to get around.
And just a last question, what does bike riding mean for you?
I need to get some kind of exercise every day, and that sort of fills that hole. And going to the gym is great, but it takes a bunch of time. Whereas if I got out on the bike, I had to, and use it for transport, I get my exercise as well as getting where I'm going. So it is extremely time efficient. So that's what it means.
So you're on a bike right now.
Yes.
Do you get around primarily by bicycle?
Yes, either that or walking or the bus.
Why do you choose to get around by those modes of transportation rather than driving?
Well, right now I don't have a car. Haven't had a car for 8 years.
For 8 years?
Yes. But actually I'm going to buy a car now.
Oh, okay.
Just to give me more mobility getting out of town in that way. But mostly in town I ride my bike or get it. It's fine.
Yeah. You enjoy it?
Oh, yes, very much.
What are some of the benefits of riding by bike?
You don't have to worry about parking.
That's a huge benefit.
And it gives you exercise, and you can stop off here and there wherever you want to, so it's not such a hassle.
Did the environment and the sustainability factor play a role in your decision to ride a bike to get around?
I guess so. I guess what I found with the car, as I say, it's been several years, and it's just convenient living in this area, also along 4th Avenue. Just live a block from here, so everything's very accessible anyway for shopping and walking and doing that.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.